Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Last week, as the world watched Beijing, a war started in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. When Georgian troops attempted to retake the breakaway pro-Russian enclave of South Ossetia, Russia responded with massive force. Now Russian tanks have moved into the heart of Georgia as ground troops battle with heavy casualties on both sides. This is the real thing, and the rest of the world is watching anxiously to see what happens next. What does Russia's military action mean for the nation's relationship with the U.S. and with the rest of the world? This hour On Point, Russia, Georgia, and what's at stake in the Caucasus. Joining us first this hour from Moscow is Anne Barnard. She's a reporter for The New York Times. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What's the latest in terms of the fighting, in terms of the escalation of this conflict?
Well, there was a fair amount of bombing this morning, Russian bombing in several cities across Georgia. This evening, we're not hearing too much about intense fighting, although there's an interesting new development. Our reporter in Sanaki, which is a town in the west of Georgia, just saw Russian troops occupying a military base in Sanaki, a Georgian military base. They told him, "We're here to take care of the situation," and they said they're there to prevent a repeat of the South Ossetian situation where Russians say that Georgian troops shelled Russian peacemakers, peacekeeping troops. So this is the first time that we've seen Russian troops occupying an area inside Georgia proper, not inside one of the two separatist territories that are pro-Russian, where the Russians have been massing their troops. This doesn't mean that there's been a big battle deep inside Georgia, in the west of Georgia, but it is an interesting indication that the Russians are going beyond the autonomous areas.
Well, that's what I'm reading in the AP Wire, that Russia may be opening a second front of fighting. Is this that? And can you tell us about what the potential is of this spreading?
Well, as we've seen in this conflict, small skirmishes can very quickly blow up into big battles unpredictably. So anything can happen. Our reporter came under bombing right in the area where the Russian troops were. So there is military action going on there. But right now, there is not fighting, there is not ground combat in that area.
The major powers are just now calling for Russia to accept a ceasefire on Georgia's part. Do you see that happening?
Well, Russia so far has not responded to these calls. They say that they want Georgia to agree to renounce all use of force in South Ossetia. At this point, I don't think the two sides have come to a mutual understanding of what is required for a ceasefire.
I'm reading stories today that speak of ethnic cleansing and genocide. Can you describe for us the human crisis, the humanitarian and the refugee situation in the region?
Well, it's very difficult to get to the heart of the area where the Russians say there have been 2,000 deaths in Sanaki. We have not been there ourselves, so we can't confirm those reports. But we've seen footage of people huddling in basements, fleeing in their pajamas. Then in cities in Georgia, our reporter just saw a group of refugees who had fled one of the separatist regions in fighting 15 years ago. Now they've come under bombing again in Sanaki, where they had taken refuge in sort of a dormitory that was damaged in the bombing two days ago. Mm-hmm. One old man who had been living in this refugee shelter for 15 years said, the Russians drove us out of Abkhazia. Now we're staying funeral here. He was referring to several people who lived in the dorm with him who he said were killed in the bombing.
Well, Anne Barnard, I appreciate your time with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anne Barnard covers Russia for The New York Times. Joining us now from Moscow is Marcia Lipman. She's the editor of the journal Pro et Contra, published by the Carnegie Center in Moscow, and an expert in the center's civil society program. She also has served as deputy editor for two Russian weekly newspapers and magazines, and is a columnist for the Washington Post op-ed page. Marcia Lipman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Put this into context for us, if you would, Marcia. What's the significance of this region, and what's the potential impact of this conflict?
Well, the significance cannot be exaggerated. I think what we are having today is a changed situation with Russia in the world. This is the first time Russia has projected its military force outside of its borders since the collapse of the USSR. And the West did not, or could not, or would not do anything to prevent this from happening. And now that this military campaign is unfolding, it doesn't look like the West has an immediate response and can stop it or can soften Russian stance.
Let's hear some sound now from both sides. Masha, here is at the UN Security Council meeting, Georgia's ambassador to the UN saying that Russia is trying to do what it did in Chechnya, ethnic cleansing.
This is exactly what it is Russia's intention, to erase Georgian statehood, to exterminate Georgian people.
And at a UN Security Council meeting, also Russia's UN ambassador says through an interpreter that Georgia started the conflict.
The military action by Georgia began when they started to attack our peacekeepers.
So points, counterpoints, Masha Lipman, tell us, what is the truth? How did this start?
There's no doubt that Georgia started it. And actually, a Russian action that is now evolving as a military campaign in Georgia originally was Russia's response to Georgian attempt to quickly over one of the two breakaway territories, South Ossetia. It may be that Georgian president picked especially the day of the opening of the Olympics, thinking he could probably succeed fast without the world looking and seeing the cost, the human cost of the retaking of control. He did not succeed in doing this, and I think it was a very bad miscalculation on his part to have even tried, because he should have expected that Russia, of course, would respond to this. Among South Ossetian population, many carry Russian passports, and Russia had its own peacekeepers. So when that population was attacked by the Georgians, and when Russian peacekeepers were attacked and Russia claims many of them were killed, Russia, of course, was forced to act. And the way it acted led to this unfolding, to this escalating military campaign, which is now being expanded into Georgia. Now,
so here, let me take it from this point. Here we are. We're at this moment. Now, is it about overthrowing Georgia's president? Is it about is this a full scale invasion of Georgia now at this point? I mean, how far do you see this going?
Well, of course, we do not know exactly what Russia's goals are. Official Russia continues to say that this is a peacekeeping operation continued, as Prime Minister, ex-president Vladimir Putin.
Masha, are you there? I think we lost the line to Moscow. Do we have our other guest? Let's bring in now Robert Kagan. He's joining us from McLean, Virginia. He's contributing editor at the Weekly Standard and the New Republic, and a columnist for the Washington Post. His column is in today's Washington Post. It's titled, Putin Makes His Move. Robert Kagan, nice to have you with us. Thanks.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So what's your response to what we heard of Masha Lipman suggesting that Georgia started this and Russia's responding appropriately?
Well, if you only look at what's happened in the past few days, it's certainly Georgia's action in attempting to sort of reestablish itself in southern Ossetia that led to this chain of events. But unfortunately, that's not a sufficiently wide focus to take. The fact is that Putin has been putting pressure on Georgia for years, ever since the so-called Rose Revolution, which put a democratically elected president in power. In Georgia, following that election, started tilting west. Russia has placed economic sanctions on Georgia, has embargoed trade with Georgia, and more recently has been stepping up its support for rebels in South Ossetia to increase their attacks on Georgian positions. So everybody was sort of hoping that Saakashvili would tolerate this indefinitely. You know, Russians were doing overflights of Georgian territory with the military jets. Finally, I guess Saakashvili, you know, didn't feel like he wanted to take it anymore, and he's taken this action. But I think we need to see that what was really going on here has been Russia has been sort of trying to force Saakashvili to make such a move so they can undertake this kind of operation. This didn't just materialize overnight. Clearly, Russian forces were in place, including Russian naval forces, which are now being used. This is part of a much larger strategy by Putin to subjugate a neighboring country which has been too pro-Western from his point of view.
Bob Kagan, you said this didn't just happen overnight, but it does seem to have boiled over quite quickly. Are you surprised by how fast this has slipped into crisis?
You know, one is always surprised when conflict breaks out where it hadn't existed before, but then once it's clear what Putin's game was in this situation, then nothing is really that surprising, including the possibility, and I tend to agree with Masha on this point, that Russia's ambitions, Putin's ambitions in Georgia, go beyond sort of retaking South or annexing South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and may include the toppling of Saakashvili and putting in a government that will be friendly to Russia. It's possible that the Russians don't feel like they should have gone through all this military effort and not get that kind of outcome, which will be, of course, an extraordinary development.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the fighting between Russia and Georgia. Masha Lipman is back with us from Moscow. She's an expert on Russia at the Carnegie Center in Moscow. Robert Kagan is also with us, contributing editor at the Weekly Standard and the New Republic, and a columnist for the Washington Post. I'd like to play some sound now from an interview yesterday from Beijing. President Bush, he's speaking with Bob Costas of NBC Sports. President says that the violence being waged in Georgia is unacceptable.
I express my grave concern about the disproportionate response of Russia, and that we strongly condemn bombing outside of South Ossetia.
Bob Kagan, has the U.S. response been appropriate?
Well, so far there hasn't been much of a U.S. response. I mean,
beyond a statement? Yeah.
Beyond statements, beyond Bush sort of yucking it up with Vladimir Putin at the Beijing Olympics.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a little bit, I must say, disappointed in the administration's reaction. There have been a couple of strong statements about Russia having to withdraw all its troops from Georgia, but then other statements suggesting the forces stand down, so there seems to be a little bit of confusion. And, you know, very little in the way of even diplomatic action. Now, I gather maybe in the next day or so that will begin to change, But so far, I think the administration has been caught wrong-footed on this one.
Let me bring in another voice now to respond to that and other things. From Washington, D.C., Stephen Sestanovich. He's a senior fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor at Columbia University. He was an advisor to Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and is former ambassador-at-large and special advisor to the Secretary of State for Policy toward the states of the former Soviet Union. Stephen Sestanovich, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
What do you think is the appropriate U.S. response at this point?
Well, you know, it's harder to know what to do until you decided what it means. And I think that's what the U.S. and its allies are struggling with in these few days. The most important thing they have to reckon with is not looking at this or that kind of marginal response, which probably won't have very much impact in the ongoing Russian campaign. I think it's clear they've pretty much decided what they're going to do. They haven't told us yet, but we're going to find out. The real issue is whether we begin to think about Russia in a fundamentally different way. And that's the difference between, for example, President Bush saying that this is an issue that calls for great grave concern, for example. And on the other hand, thinking of Russia as now a fundamentally different kind of state in Europe. We have a war in Europe, And the issue is whether we begin to think of Russia as a challenger, a disturber to the European order, a kind of outlaw state, to put it in extreme terms, and an aggressor. You know, those are words that represent a different optic on this, mm-hmm. as opposed to seeing it as just a kind of bump in the road.
Bob Kagan, what's your response to that? The real issue here is got to think about Russia in a fundamentally different way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we've been very slow, actually. And again, I think the Bush administration has been very slow to realize that this Russia is not some wonderful partner in our great international community. For some time now, it's been very clear that Putin's Russia has got a big chip on its shoulder from the end of the Cold War. Putin has said very clearly that the fall of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, and that his goal is to, as best he can, reestablish a sort of what he considers Russia's traditional sphere of influence, which extends not only to the countries immediately on Russia's border, but also moves into Central Europe, Poland, which at least needs to be neutralized as a strategic factor from the Russian point of view. We have, you know, sort of hoped that he would just use his oil and gas wealth as leverage to try to get what he wanted, to do things rather peacefully. But now he's demonstrated something quite extraordinary, and I do think it completely changes our view of things, that he is in fact willing to use military force in a cross-border aggression against one of these neighboring states. That's a new world that we live in now, or rather, perhaps maybe it's a very old kind of world, a kind of 19th century world.
Masha Lippman, fall in on this point. Do you agree or disagree with Bob and Stephen about thinking about Russia in a fundamentally different way?
Well, first of all, I would see the U.S. bears responsibility for what is happening now. I think the U.S. strongly supported President Saakashvili of Georgia. The U.S. administration helped Georgia to train its military forces. Mm-hmm. However, being such a strong backer of Georgia, I think the U.S. failed to make sure that it can, in fact, control what Georgia is doing. I cannot imagine that America, had it known that Saakashvili was going to attack South Ossetia like this, would have approved it. So America did not make sure it knew what its ally in the Caucasus was doing, nor was it prepared to help Saakashvili in a situation where he found himself now. And indeed, it would be inconceivable to engage militarily and help Saakashvili, which he probably imagined, fantasized the U.S. would do. So in the end, having associated so closely with Saakashvili, but not making sure it would and control and help Georgia, I think America has eventually played a destabilizing role. Now, on the issue that it's time America thinks differently about Russia, well, I think it is high time, and I think America has overlooked the way Russia evolved as a strong country, and not just as strong and self-assertive, but as we're now seeing, I think unexpectedly to many of us, Russia ready to act militarily, to actually attack a foreign country.
I've got a question from a caller here, and I want to bring Clay in now from Portsmouth, Rhode Island. This will give us a little more context here. Clay, go ahead. Welcome to On Point.
And my question is that I don't really know anything about the history of this conflict. How far back does it go? I guess we've had perspectives from a few days ago since this immediate situation started, from years and months ago. 10 years ago, I guess, there was a referendum in which the people of South Ossetia want to secede from Georgia. But how far back does this conflict go? I mean, Ottoman Empire or generations before that?
Clay, thank you. It's a great question. Let's turn to Masha Lippman. History in a nutshell here. Masha, what's the history? What divides these regions?
Well, we can, of course, go back to the 19th century when Russia had waged wars in the Caucasus, but I would rather go back to early 90s. USSR. There were two breakaway territories, three actually at that time, breakaway territories in the country of Georgia. And when Mikhail Saakashvili, current president, came to power, he came to power as president in a peaceful revolution with a claim to retake the breakaway territories. And this was an extremely important issue to him. He pledged to his nation he would do it. He reclaimed one of the three territories very quickly and easily. The other two proved to be outside his capacity. Mm. Now, Russia, which saw Georgia as a country which was strongly pro-Western, sought membership in NATO, and Russia was vehemently opposed to the expansion of NATO, bringing it close to its borders, tried to interfere with the political desires and designs of President Saakashvili, and it strongly backed the breakaway territories. So the conflict that originally erupted with a short but bloody military conflict in early 90s began to get hotter and hotter in recent time. Mm. First after, I think most importantly, very lately after the visit of Condoleezza Rice to Georgia, where it expressed, she expressed once again very strong support to Georgian president against his breakaway territories and supported his desire to join NATO. Mm. After that, the aggravation was really, really hot, with shootouts almost on a daily basis, with casualties at that time small on both sides. And eventually, here's where we are. President Saakashvili trying to retake the territory of South Ossetia, and Russia retaliating, and now Russia waging a war, with, at least bombing the Georgian territory.
And here we are. Stephen Stasanovich, respond to that. How do you see Georgia's desire or the aspirations to join NATO, or Russia's perceived humiliations by NATO by turns? How does that play into this?
Well, there are many ways of viewing this. You've got a small country that has seen it as part of its effort to kind of put the past behind it, both its past as a part of the Russian Empire, its past as part of the, you know, the Soviet system. It's seen it as part, an indispensable, integral part of that effort to associate itself with the West, to become a democracy, to become part of Western institutions. And, you know, the kind of core principle of American foreign policy since the end of the Cold War is we take all comers. If countries want to work with us on common problems, want to define themselves with us, and they seem to be able to contribute, seem to be like us, we're ready for that. For the Russians in the 90s, that wasn't a really big issue. There were difficulties, but the principle of accepting the independence of other countries of the former Soviet Union and their rights to make their own choices about who they were affiliated with, that was basically recognized. And Russian leaders have repeatedly said, you know, if other countries want to be part of a, you know, another security alliance, that's okay. We have our, we don't like it, but we understand their rights. Now we have a kind of change in the framework, and Russia feels that it has the opportunity to roll back that reality. Mm-hmm. And the conflict in South Ossetia and Abkhazia are instruments, really, for that kind of broader purpose. I think they're less central in the Russian conception of this new phase of their foreign policy than the broader desire to undo what they think of as unfair developments that weakened them in over the past 25 years.
Bob Kagan, what's your response to all that?
Well, I agree with Steve. I think it's a mistake. There are to focus too narrowly on, you know, who shot John in South Ossetia. There are these kinds of disputes exist all over the world. There's a lot of breakaway movements. There's Catalonia and Spain. You know, sometimes the Scots want to break away from the United Kingdom, but that is not what's at issue here. Steve is exactly right. What's at issue is a much larger ambition on the part of Putin and Russia to establish its hegemony in its region and to reestablish, at the very least, the Soviet space and Russian influence. And, you know, there are always these kinds of incidents. I mean, people who remember the 1930s, there was the whole Sudeten crisis involving the Sudeten Germans of Czechoslovakia. The Sudeten Germans had a point. They were being oppressed. The British government, other governments thought they were being mistreated by the Czechoslovakian government, but that's not what Hitler was worried about. He was interested in invading Czechoslovakia. So we need to understand the larger picture here. And I just want to make the point, and this is something that the Swedish Foreign Minister Carl Bildt has said. What's particularly worrying about this is that if this is a question of Russia feeling it must protect Russian citizens, and sort of the Russian policy in South Ossetia was to hand out passports and make sure these people were considered Russian citizens, well, Russia has got, there are Russian citizens in countries everywhere along Russia's border, from the Baltics all the way down to Central Asia. And if Russia is going to use protection of Russians living overseas as an excuse for intervention, then we are in for a long and very difficult century.
Let's go back to the phones now before our break. Art is in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Art.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm appalled by one-sided coverage of this conflict in American media. And I just wanted to underline the fact again that close to 2,000 people were killed by Georgian forces at the beginning of the conflict. And blaming just Russia makes this discussion just very one-sided, and it's a double standard. For instance, Kosovo was allowed to have its independence, and the city can't. Kosovo's people got protection from Serbs, and Assyrians cannot get the protection from Germans. This is just unacceptable.
Art, I appreciate your perspective, and I'm really glad you called. Masha Lippman, do you want to respond to the caller, Art? Masha, are you? We've lost you in Moscow again. Those lines are hard to keep down in Moscow. Robert Kagan, would you respond to our caller who thinks this is just purely one-sided on this?
Well, I mean, you know, there's no question that you're going to get a kind of a slant in most democratic countries, which is, especially in Europe and the United States, which is somewhat critical, more critical of the Russian position than the Georgian position. I think that's because people understand perfectly well what's going on here. You know, there's no excusing the killing of civilians. There's no, these things are perpetrated by many countries around the world, and it's always bad. But if we do not understand what Putin's motives are, then we do not understand what's going on here. And I think that, you know, while I understand a Russian point of view, I think that it is ultimately a wrong point of view, and that what Russia is engaged in here is an attempt to extend its hegemony over neighboring countries.
Another call now from Pete, who's on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Pete.
I have to agree with the previous caller that it's one-sided. I mean, recently, I guess Bush said that they're seeking regime change. I mean, where do we get the moral authority now to say to Russia or any other country that they can't do what they're doing when we have done the same thing in Iraq? We sought regime change there. We invaded a sovereign nation. I mean, we did everything that the Russians are doing today, and yet we're criticizing them. We have lost our moral authority to tell any other country that they can't do what we do. And the thing about that is that when other countries do what we do, we take the attitude they're wrong and we're right because we're a democracy and they're not, and therefore they don't know what's right and wrong. And I think that's the problem. We need to start walking our talk and stop trying to preach to other people not to do what we're doing here. I mean, I love the U.S. I'm a United States citizen, but, you know, the reason our standing in the world is suffering is because we do one thing and say another.
Pete, thank you. I'm sorry to cut you, but we've got to go to a break, and I want to get Masha Lippman responding to this point before we do. Masha, go ahead.
Yes, no, thank you. Of course, the coverage is biased. It is biased on both sides. I think this always happens. Both coverages are in favor of one side. Here in Russia, we also have a very one-sided coverage of it, this is to say the least. However, I think there is a very strong point that the listener made, and I agree. One way to look at what Russia is doing now is making up for the past humiliation, seeing America doing what it pleases without consulting with other nations, attacking when it feels like attacking. This is certainly how it is viewed from Russia. And now when Russia finally has the strength to act in a similar fashion, it is more sending a message, now I can do this too, and there is nothing that you can oppose to it. This has to do with Russia's past humiliations that were very strongly underestimated in the United States and in the West.
Yes. Masha, the clock's against me. We're going to go to a break here. We'll talk more after this break about Russia, Georgia, and what's next. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the conflict between Russia and Georgia. We're joined this hour by Masha Lipman, Robert Kagan, and Stephen Sestanovich. I'd like to hear some sound now from both sides on this. First, in an interview with Sky News, a member of the Georgian parliament said that Russia is trying to undermine the government in Tbilisi.
Unless somehow very strong and clear voices from international community are raised, nothing might stop the president of Russia from this predatory behavior.
And here's Russia's deputy foreign minister defending Moscow's decision to bomb targets near the Georgian capital, Tbilisi.
When the wide-scale military actions is underway, obviously the military, we very much interested to neutralize the infrastructure which is supporting the opposite side.
Let's go back to the phones now right out of the gate here and get some callers in. Got some good ones here. Nick is in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Would our resident experts agree that since 1989, the makers of American diplomacy have misunderstood the depth of Russian nationalism, and would they agree that we seem to think as American diplomatists that everybody else acts on principles, whereas comparing Russian behavior in Chechnya and now Russian behavior in Georgia, we see a sort of a contradiction where the Russians can suppress a breakaway republic and not grant that same privilege to the Georgians? I'll take my answer off the air, please.
Nick, thank you. I appreciate it. Bob Kagan, let's turn that question to you. Have we miscalculated Russian nationalism here?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that it's true that over the decade, especially after the end of the Cold War, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the United States and Europe, I mean, this isn't just an American decision, went ahead and enlarged NATO, moved the European Union, you know, started moving closer to Russian borders. I think we were, it wasn't so much we didn't read Russian nationalism. I think the point that Steve Sestanovich has made is the key point. The democratic Russia, the Boris Yeltsin's Russia, was perhaps, you know, not delighted to see this movement, but they did not consider the eastward expansion of democratic nations to be a threat to a democratic Russia. And that's the big difference here. As Putin has consolidated an autocracy in Russia, he does conceive of democratic pro-Western nations to be a threat not only to Russia, but to his ability to control Russia, his autocratic system. And so he has, of course there is Russian nationalism, but he has deliberately fanned this Russian nationalism as a means of both consolidating his own support at home and also projecting a more powerful Russia on the world stage. So, you know, you can I know the caller isn't doing this, but other callers have. You can blame the United States for everything that goes wrong in the world, but I think sometimes we have to understand there were decisions taken by other leaders, in this case Vladimir Putin, which was independent of actions that we'd taken and might have occurred no matter what we did.
Masha Lipman, let me turn back to you in Moscow here for a moment, because I'd like you to respond to Bob Kagan's comments before the break, this historical comparison of Putin and Hitler. Where do you fall on that?
Well, I don't think this comparison actually makes sense. I really would not even comment. Of course, President Putin was increasingly authoritarian in his rule, but he was a soft authoritarian ruler, and he did not resort, or almost did not resort to repression, let alone attack nations outside of his borders during his presidency. So I really don't buy it. I think on the issue of nationalism, I think what was created and probably not paid due attention to was not just Russian nationalism, but Russian wounded pride and prestige. When Russia was weak during the 90s, it was easily taken for granted as NATO expansion against Russian will. When Russia grew stronger, it began to retort angrily, but only rhetorically, and still it was dismissed. Putin tried to sober up the world community, giving his Munich speech, which again was dismissed and something that's not important. Still, NATO expansion continued to go ahead, and Kosovo independence and other issue of that Russia was very much against. The West also went ahead with those, ignoring Russian opinion. Now, when Russia had a pretext in a very serious and solid one for this matter in South Ossetia. It finally acted, and in this fashion, it is sending its signal. Not that I justify, of course I do not. I'm just trying to explain how what sentiment is moving, is driving my country and the leadership of this country.
Is that Stephen who's trying to talk up?
No, this is Bob.
Bob, go ahead.
I just want to correct the record. I did not say that Putin was Hitler. I simply went back and looked at another historical example of a nationality that was oppressed and was and which served as a pretext for action. I'm not saying that Putin is Hitler.
Steve Sasanovich, jump in here. What's your response to all that you've been hearing?
Well, look, we're maybe making this a little too Russo-American. We've got a lot of other countries in Europe that are going to be heard from and that need to be heard from, and it gets to the question of, you know, the standing of the United States. I think there's no doubt that the United States' ability to lead on this issue is damaged by its weakened international position, and that's something that Putin has definitely factored into his calculations. Russian officials and commentators for years now have been saying, you know, the United States is weak, and that gives Russia an opportunity to reassert itself. The question is how to do that, of course. I mentioned other European countries. You know, there are plenty of European countries that were deeply, deeply critical of what the United States did in Iraq. And there's no inconsistency for them in speaking up against what Russia has done. It's a little more difficulty for the United States, and I've suggested that. But what's interesting now is going to be whether the United States and its allies can come together to reach a kind of consensus about what this means and how they ought to respond to it. And in doing that, they shouldn't be burdened by questions about interpreting the recent past or who likes American foreign policy and who doesn't. They really need to think about what kind of problem we have on our hands.
Back to the phones now. Let's invite some more callers. Peter is first up in Boston. Go ahead, Peter. Hi.
Yeah, some of my points. Thank you, Jen. Some of the points that I wanted to make may already have been made. But I don't know if I heard any talk of the expansion of NATO right up to the border of Russia. And the deployment or the proposed deployment of anti-missile systems, you know, close to Russian border again in Poland and other places. And all this talk of Russian nationalism, you know, the United States has a huge double standard. You know, what do you see in the United States nowadays? It is all nationalism, you know, and when other nations become economically powerful, nationalism is an inevitability, you know, and there is no point in the decrying nationalism, when you yourself, I mean, this country is itself very nationalistic.
I appreciate that perspective, Peter. Thank you for calling. Another call here from Bill in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, go ahead, Bill.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, this is Arthur from Tarrington, Connecticut. And I think that we're looking at a situation in which is the United States is once again going to be humiliated. We have to be realistic and understand that Russia is a very strong military power. We encouraged the Georgians to provoke Russia, and now what are we going to do about it? It looks like another case where we've supported a democratic country and then not been able to do anything to save them.
Mm. Bill, thank you. I'm sorry I got your name wrong. Appreciate your call. I do have a question for the panel. I was reading this morning in one piece that in some form, in some way, some of this conflict has to do with oil and gas in the region and the access to it. Is that true? And to what extent does that play into this? Bob Kagan, Stephen Sestanovich?
Go ahead.
One of the ways in which the Georgians first tried to gain some independence in the 90s was by making their country a transit route for oil that was coming out of the Caspian, and they saw this as a way of getting themselves out of the kind of Russian economic grip. Russia opposed the building of that pipeline and has subsequently opposed the sort of the moves that would undermine their monopoly of energy exports from the former Soviet Union to world markets. How large a role that plays in in this particular conflict, I think it's kind of hard to say, because the that pipeline has been up and running, and in the course of that time, the Russian energy position has only grown. It's not really threatened by that or by other pipelines. I think other factors tend to be more important here, but there's no doubt that Russians see energy as their lever back onto the world stage.
Mm. Masha Lipman, agree or disagree? One more time, the line to Moscow is down. We'll try to get her back. In the meantime, go ahead, Bob. Do you have a comment?
No, I agree with Steve's analysis.
Sergey is on the line from Warren, Rhode Island. Sergey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. How you doing? My comment on the theme would be that I think that your panel in the U.S. is a little bit incompetent in the matters. I think, thank God for Masha Lipman from Moscow, that at least she's trying to represent another point of view. I think some people on the panel should read the history a little bit more and talk about the Saakashvili past history and the Saakashvili's present history. Because to all the crimes he perpetrated in Georgia against his own people, he now can add something in the vein of Saddam Hussein. Because if he claims that the Southern Ossetia is a part of Georgia, he just killed 2,000 of his own citizens. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Sergey, thanks so much. Masha Lipman, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and respond to the caller, if you would.
I only heard the end of it on the 2,000 casualties in South Ossetia. Actually, I do not think we should trust at this point any of the numbers reported on either side. I think it's been all saying that the truth dies first is the first casualty of the war, so I do not think we should believe the 2,000. However, this being said, of course, there were casualties and the first-hand evidence from South Ossetia from the refugees. In more trusted sources, indicates that indeed there was indiscriminate fire for a long time, for long, long hours in South Ossetia, in the city of Tsin Valley. Of course, the number of casualties is high, and the blame for this lies certainly on President Saakashvili.
More callers here, and I want to get as many in as we can. Mario is in Clinton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mario. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Well, I want to make a point that one of the things that puts us in the situation is basically, maybe it seems like a stretch, but it's a lack of a U.S. Energy policy that, among other things, has caused demand for oil to go up instead of down, and has created a situation where high oil prices are giving nations like Russia a lot of power, which they didn't have before. So they can afford to take bold actions like they're doing now. But another point I wanted to make to respond to the gentleman on the panel also is that he said that Russia is using defending Russian citizens as an excuse for this action, but that's exactly what we did in Grenada. And going back to the caller from Boston, I think it's time that the U.S. starts limiting its hypocritical approach to foreign policy, because although maybe we are not given the right information, people in other countries see what's happening and they make their own judgments.
Mario, thanks. Let's take another call now. Mark, who's in Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, go ahead, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, sorry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think we tend to idealistically look at these as zero-sum games, that we have to either be for Russia or be supportive of Georgia. But in fact, it's not that way. And I think that the U.S., we have to acknowledge that that Russia has violated the sovereign integrity of Georgia and use diplomacy to address that, and also to try to diplomatically help Georgia, come to some kind of a diplomatic arrangement with Ossetia, instead of looking at one as the good guy and one as the bad guy. Russia is not our enemy anymore, and they're a competitor. They're big and strong, and we're going to have to have a relationship with them as we go along, along with China and other countries. And things have changed since you know, this idealistic look at principles in foreign policy.
Mark, you make a good point. Thank you for your call. Stephen Sestanovich, talk about that. How seriously should the U.S. treat this as a sort of watershed moment in our relations with Russia?
Well, I think the caller has described very effectively an approach to dealing with Russia that has basically been the approach of American policy for the past 15 years. That is seeing the states of the former Soviet Union as ones that we can have good relations with, both of, you know, the Russians and the countries that don't get along well with Russia, trying to provide a kind of balance between them, see that we have different interests in each case, and strengthen our ties with all of them. And I think that has been a basically an effective policy. It's one that has continued right up to the present day. You know, President Bush, when he was interviewed in Beijing, was talking about what a good relationship he had with his friend Vladimir. But I think it's more at risk now.
Let me jump in and ask Bob Kagan in just 20 seconds to respond to the same question as we wrap up. Bob?
Look, I think that we have, in fact, conducted a fairly balanced policy here. Nobody has painted this in black and white terms. The administration has urged Saakashvili to not rise to these Russian provocations on several occasions. Has been critical of the Saakashvili government on numerous occasions for a variety of reasons. This general effort to say that what Russia is doing now is the fault of the United States, I find very disheartening, because what we have here is, in fact, a power play by Russia and Putin using military force, and I think we should stop, you know, looking in the mirror for the answer to what's going on here.
Masha Lipman, 20 seconds, your final word.
Well, I'm afraid we are dangerously close to a zero-sum game, if we're not there already. And I think it's come to this gradually. I think it was generally overlooked as to how Russia was evolving over time. And this could have been avoided, and actually policy should have been made on more understanding and more knowledge about Russia. And then probably we wouldn't be now where we are.
I appreciate my panel being here today. A fascinating discussion with some thoughtful insights. Masha Lipman from Moscow, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Stephen Sestanovich from Washington, D.C. I appreciate your time, Steve.
Thanks.
And Bob Kagan from McLean, Virginia. Appreciate it, Bob.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.